Welcome to the History Reviewed channel, where we analyze the lies and deceptions of history. Hi there, Brent. How are you doing?
Hello, Yon. I'm doing well, thank you.
It's good to hear in your very northern location there. And hi there, Mike. How are you?
Hi, Jan. Doing good, thanks. Good to be here. Hi, Brant.
Hello, Mike.
Well,
good day.
It's good to have you guys back here. Today, I'd like to. Today is Brant's turn to really enlighten us. And what I'd like to hear from you, Brant, are your adventures among dysfunctional non-whites. The Eskimos and I believe the Sioux Indians? Can you tell us?
Well, I'm not going to say which tribe it is right now, but I'll just say
okay.
It's an American Indian tribe.
Okay.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Would you like me to start or are the questions first?
No, go for it. You tell us and we'll ask questions afterwards.
Okay, so I think the purpose of this is not to denigrate Eskimos or Indians or to say how dysfunctional we are and white people are so much better than them, but to give a little bit of information to people who have never experienced that and they don't understand what the differences are and how important it is to live in a civilization that is built up to your standards and it reflects your biospirit. It's something that you're comfortable in. I spent a couple years in an Eskimo village teaching elementary school, and I was shocked to see, you know, from a white person's point of view, to use your word, how dysfunctional it truly was. For example, most of the teachers there were white, and they were not allowed to drink alcohol, and the people in the village technically were not allowed to drink alcohol either, but the Eskimos would drink alcohol anyway because they would bootleg it in from another village. And you know, at night, while I'm, you know, grading papers or trying to get ready for the next day, there would be drunk Eskimos just yelling profanities, you know, out there in the little village because they're arguing with each other, or they would be drunk and riding circles around my house on a snowmobile until very, very late at night because they don't have anything that they have to do the next day. And it was just a huge mishmash between what I grew up with, what were my standards, my expectations of behavior, how do you comport yourself, how do you prepare for work? How do you do your job? How do you be professional? And contrast that with what I was seeing there. And in my first day of school, I had some assignments for the kids. And I think this school, we had two recesses during the day. And the first recess was coming around in the morning. And I had given them a little assignment. It was simple. It was kind of like a pre-test that you do with kids because you want to see how much they know before you launch into a subject. And so there were some simple little math problems, like first or second grade level. And I was teaching a combined fourth and fifth grade class. And about half the kids hadn't done anything. They put the papers down in front of them on the tables, and they just stared straight ahead. It's like they were zoned out, like they were zombies. And when the bell rang for recess, they started to get up to go. And I said, no, you're not going anywhere. You haven't even done anything. You've got to sit down and you have to do this work. And some just continued to stare. Some got angry. Some started crying. And it's in these situations where you get white teachers that come in from a white society and they come into this what's basically a foreign or an alien environment where you're thinking, what the hell is going on? And what I learned is that during the summertime with some of the Eskimos, they'll have what's called a fish camp where they will pitch up for a month or so along one of the major rivers in Alaska, and they will catch just tons of salmon during that time. And there is a distinct difference between Eskimo culture and white culture, between Indian culture and white culture. For example, compared to how whites traditionally take control of their kids, watch their behavior, watch where they are, etc., with a lot of the little Eskimo kids, they just run around like wild animals. And during the summertime, especially, they can run around like wild animals 24 hours a day because it's light outside. It's not getting dark. And so they're used to this sort of very natural, what we would consider a feral existence all summer long. And then here comes September. We take them and we put them in this rectangular building. We sit them down in a classroom and put some simple math problems in front of them and expect them to do the work. They can't, some of them just can't do it. It's too much of a switchover from their more wild, feral lifestyle to sit down like a white kid and just do your damn work. Stop making excuses. Take responsibility for your behavior. Do the damn work. You should already know how to do this. So it's these different expectations that we take as whites and we try to overlay them on top of these Eskimos and expect them to do that. The Eskimos are so dysfunctional right now because they're sort of trapped between a couple different worlds. They can't function, by and large, most of them cannot function up to white standards and white norms and what we expect. But at the same time, they cannot function the way that their elders, their ancestors did. They can't hunt and fish and survive out in the wild. They've been weaned off of that for decades from when the Russians first encountered them a little less than 200 years ago, because Alaska used to be part of Russia until the United States bought that from Russia. And they are in this sort of no man's land where they have this dependence upon alcohol, and they don't learn enough in school to where they could like move down into the United States and get a job. They get tons of assistance, different types of welfare through various either state or federal mechanisms. So a lot of them don't actually work. But they do fish and they do hunt, but they have a lot of free time on their hands. So they have, there's also a big problem with incest. For example, towards the end of the school year, they had these cultural days where we want to teach the kids some of their culture, which I think is completely appropriate. All the cultures should learn about their cultures. All cultures should learn what their ancestors did and speak your native language if you happen to have one. And you'll keep that stuff alive, but you'll be aware of how that fits in with the white culture or the other cultures. So anyway, the school wanted to bring in some of the elders to teach some of the skills that their people used to know. But it turned out that this school legally could not do that because all of the elders that could have been brought in all had incest charges against them. So you can't bring them in around little kids. And that's how screwed up it was. So are there any questions at this point? Or if not, I'll keep going.
There are plenty of questions already. So
Okay.
if I may fire away, I did a quick Google search. Would you agree that the IQ of the Eskimos is about 91?
Yes.
So that's relatively accurate. So they're not as backward as the blacks of Africa, but they are at, but 10 IQ points is quite a difference.
Right. And there are, in theory, there are different types of IQ, but then there's also
Okay.
G, which means that general IQ, which I think most often is measured by how a person can recognize patterns on an IQ test. And the patterns are presented completely independent from a culture, completely independent from a language, etc.
Yeah.
And I never gave any IQ tests to the students that I had, but over time, after you're teaching long enough and you get IEPs on kids, which means individualized education program, where you know what their IQ is, you know their learning disabilities, etc., you can generally You know what the IQ of the different kids are as you're working with them. Another problem with the Eskimos is that a significant amount of them had fetal alcohol syndrome.
What's
so
that?
that is another hurdle in trying to teach them, because that creates some significant learning disabilities.
So that's incredible.
Is this from the mother being a drunkard, basically?
Yeah, it's from the mother. Yeah, mother drinking alcohol during pregnancy. Yeah.
So they sound like that's quite a bizarre society that, it's interesting. So you're saying that Eskimos are like stuck between what they used to be versus what whites have kind of forced onto them. So they're in this weird world where they aren't capable of fully looking after themselves the way they used to, and they're like half being helped, but they also don't understand it and they don't really fit in. I do find it interesting that I'd never heard I'd never heard of or even thought or even known that that young Eskimos could be feral. So are you saying that their parents like don't discipline them, don't teach them anything, they just like leave them? What do? Do they get up in the morning and run around until they're hungry, and then get fed and then run around? You know, how do these people function?
No, it's not that bad, but with some of the families, there are several hours during the day where they just let their kids run around. Like, for example, when I first got into the village, I see little toddlers in diapers, and they're just meandering around the village with little, muddy feet. Now, the parents might feel that there's not a danger to the kids, because they know all the people in the village. The one I was in was 500 people total. They know everyone there. They're related to most of the people. And if there's any wild animals that come around, the Eskimos just shoot the shit out of them. The Eskimos just kill freaking everything. Every animal that they see, they kill it. You have to be careful. If you have a dog, you fly a dog into the village to spend the years with you teaching, you got to keep your eye on your dog and protect it all the time, and they'll shoot your dog too. So anyway, they might feel that the kids are safe, and the kids, they don't get read to. They are not challenged academically in any way. They are taught some of the skills, like for hunting, fishing, drying meat, etc. Things that are of value to the Eskimos. The kids will learn those as they grow up. But by and large, the type of education that we see as valuable as white people, that's not passed on to these kids. That's not a priority for these kids. They never had to read. They never had to create things beyond a harpoon, warm clothing, warm shelter, making kayaks, which are a great invention. That is, to give them credit, some creativity that they came up with, and they built that with just skins and driftwood and just like pieces of leftover, crap that they fashioned together to live in that very, very harsh environment. And they have been in that harsh environment for about 5,000 years, but they never evolved from that. They went there, they stayed there, they didn't continue to move down through the opening of the glaciers through Canada about 14,000 years ago when the rest of the Asians migrated down. I don't know why, it's just what they did. And to their credit, they were able to survive in this harsh environment, but still, it's one of those Stone Age environments. You know, when white people encountered a few, or I should say several tribes of people around the planet, they were basically either in the Stone Age or just slightly past the Stone Age as far as the development goes. And that's the development that the Russians first found the Eskimos in. And you're right, they're almost like children right now, where they can't do what their ancestors did. And if all of the welfare and everything was taken away by the whites, they would just die. Within a couple months, they would all be wiped out.
Brant,
go ahead. Go ahead.
Pardon the interruption. I have a question for you along those lines before this fascinating conversation evolves further about regarding their survival. So I've been to Alaska several times for industrial reasons, but never to any of those type of villages you're describing. But I did meet Alaska missionary pilots, bush pilots, who spent a lot of their life and their efforts to fly into these inaccessible villages where people don't realize people live in places there's no roads to get there. Yeah. They fly in and bring in supplies and food and clothing or medicine, whatever, you know, as sort of a missionary service or missionary lifestyle. And if you combine that with, and I don't know specifics, but with whatever welfare or, you know, government funding is happening, and you almost already answered this, but if you took away those two elements, have these people really fully lost the ability to survive? If the missionaries stopped flying in stuff, if the white teachers stopped coming in, and if all the state, you know, welfare type things, to whatever extent they're getting that, whether it's food stamps or whatever, if all of that stopped, what would be their fate?
Well, there might be like 1 in 1,000 really tough, ingenious bastards of the Eskimos that would survive. The rest of them would die off. They don't have those skills. They're dependent upon what the white man has given them now, and if that's yanked out, you know, you're pulling the carpet out from underneath them.
I also want to ask you, what about medicine? Aren't they getting medicine and doctors?
Yeah. Okay, so here's what happens. In the villages, there will be a medical clinic, and sometimes there will be a very small little it's like a one room prison with one little tiny jail cell in it that's just big enough for a person to stand up in. Sometimes that might happen. And that the law officer there is, it's kind of like a village semi-official law person, but it's not part of the state. The state is handled by Alaska state troopers that will fly out or come out on snowmobiles in the wintertime to deal with the problem. And by the time that the troopers show up, the problem is long since gone. And, you know, the Eskimos are hiding the evildoer. At that point, that just doesn't get resolved. But as far as the medicine goes, medicine does get flown out. And they are stocked in these little clinics. And the nurses, the Eskimo nurses there, they have enough training to where they can administer tests, medicine, you know, give you medicine, you know, first aid, administer first aid, those sorts of things. So there is some competence there that you can take care of in the clinics. And I will say this, that brings up something in my mind. What I noticed with the few Eskimo adults that were competent and could hold down a job and were dependable, they were ones who had been taken out of the village as kids and forced to go to boarding schools, say like in Anchorage or Fairbanks or something like that. They were taught English. They were taught how to read, how to write, how to do some math, how to take some responsibility for things. And then later on, they came back to the village. So they had a taste of that. Now, the ones that just grew up in the village, those are the ones that are, by and large, dysfunctional.
That's very interesting. You've got a bunch of interesting observations. If I may fire a few more random questions at you. I was surprised by your mention of guns. And how long have the Eskimos been using firearms?
I don't know. I would imagine that it was not too long after they encountered the Russians in... Let me see.
Because
1840s, 1850s, something like that.
Because judging by what you're saying, they seem like they are very functional with firearms, very comfortable with guns.
Oh yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that,
yeah, they're very comfortable with any implements that's used for hunting, trapping, fishing, they're very comfortable with that. That is a part of their lifestyle. And that's, like I said, those are some of the skills that are passed on to their kids.
That's very interesting, because blacks also had access to guns in Africa. And you can actually read of blacks with weapons, and yet the blacks were not very good with them. But the Eskimos sound, the Eskimos are not only higher IQ, but they sound like they're much more competent and comfortable with a firearm. And also, when you mentioned the kids using snowmobiles, that sounded like they're also quite happy there.
Yeah, there's a tremendous amount of use of snowmobiles and four-wheelers, or what some people call a quad runner.
Yes, a
or
quad.
An ATV.
Yes.
Yeah, a quad. So with quads, you can ride those around year-round unless the snow is very, very deep. And with the snowmobiles, of course, you can ride them around in the snow. You can also ride snowmobiles across water. But a lot of people don't know that. But if you get it up to a high speed and you've got these tracks on the backside and the front are skis, you hit the water at a high speed, you can go right straight across to the other bank, to the other side of the water, even when it's not frozen. So with the snowmobile, you can actually drive over anything. You're just going to mess it up a bit. And there's only a few normal vehicles there. Because a vehicle has to be sent down on a barge.
Wow.
Either coming down one of the main rivers, or it comes up from Seattle, comes around the other way around. And you're only going to drive back and forth inside the village. You're not going to drive anywhere else. So it doesn't really make sense to have a normal vehicle.
So let me just ask you, out of curiosity, this village that you're at, you lived there and worked there for a couple of years all year round?
Yes.
All year round?
No, during the summertime, I went back to the States for a couple of months to visit my friends, relatives, etc. And then I went back before the school year started.
So you are there during the winter?
Yeah. Yep.
you're a man who's into tough winters. That must be nasty, eh?
Well, that's why I tell people when they're complaining about the winter, I say, wait a second, I used to live in Alaska. This is not a big deal. Like, you don't understand. Or people say, I live in this teeny tiny little town. It's hard to buy things. And I'm isolated. Like, no, you're not. You have roads that go to your town. Live in a place where there's no roads. Then you're isolated.
Wow. That's right. Fascinating.
Here's another thing that I want to say. I was never dishonest with any of the kids that I ever taught, regardless of what race they were. And I would purposely bring up the differences between whites and Eskimos while I was teaching the kids, not because I was trying to insult them or say that it's, you know, one race is better than the other or whatever, but I was trying to point out the differences between the races and There's a lot of animosity towards white people with the Eskimos, and there's animosity towards whites with different Indian tribes, et cetera, and you know, with blacks. Like, we all get that. And what I would say to the kids is say, look, like, no, I can understand where there's animosity for different reasons, because I understand psychology, even if other people don't know why they're pissed off. And I'd say, look, if you want to beat the white people, you're going to have to beat the white people at their own game. You're going to have to be better than white people, which means you're going to have to start reading. You're going to have to do your math. You're going to have to learn science. You're going to have to learn all of these things that white people mastered because they had a high-functioning society for a couple thousand years. White people have already done all the work required to do that. You haven't done that. But you can do that if you want to, but you have to put in the work. So I was just completely honest with the kids, as I've always been with people. And a lot of the kids, I absolutely adored them. I've adored the, you know, kids that I've had from all different races. I mean, quote, being racist or whatever, that's a bunch of horseshit as far as I'm concerned. That has nothing to do with it. It's about being honest, seeing the differences between people and understanding why they don't fit, understanding, you know, why it's constant effort, why some of the whites are pissed off, why some of the Eskimos are pissed off. Like, to me, it was like, trying to mix oil and water to get something that's functioning between the whites and the Eskimos in those villages. And you're constantly putting effort. The white teachers are constantly putting in all of this extra effort just to barely make it work. If that effort was just slowed down, everything would just go back to shit instantly. And like, for example, in the summertime, the houses that the teachers lived in that were owned by the school district and the schools would have wood nailed around all the windows, because if they weren't, the Eskimo kids would break all of the windows. And while you live there,
Why?
anything that you leave outside is either going to be broken or stolen. And that's just the way that it is. It's a reality that you have to contend with if you go to a place like that.
So my question is why? Why do they break it or steal it? Are they doing
Well,
it out of
okay.
anger? Are they doing it out of anger and hatred, or is it just their society or what?
Well, it's going to be a little bit different depending upon the actual person that's doing it. It's going to be a mix of all of those things to greater or lesser degrees. Some of the kids are going to do it just because it's fun to throw rocks through glass and it doesn't cost them anything. See, the schools, the medicine, the transportation, the welfare, etc., all that's given to them free. They don't have to work for any of that, so they don't have value for it. They just break shit and then white people will come back and replace it. Well, they don't care. Now, there's some other places like what's it called? I think it's called the Bering Strait School District. There is an island that's halfway between Russia and Alaska. I think it's called St. Lawrence Island. You can look that up on a globe or a map. And it's a type of Eskimo called Yupik Eskimo, Yupik from Asia. They're more Asian than Alaskan. And I talked to a lot of the teachers. When they first arrived at that school district on this big island that has a bunch of seals around on the outside on the perimeter of it, they get off the plane, and as they're walking towards the teacher housing, the little Eskimo kids are up on top of these buildings throwing rocks at the teachers, pelting them. And that's their welcome to the village.
Wow.
So there's some animosity, there's some hate, there's doing it just out of boredom or fun. When things are stolen, when they're breaking things, or let me talk about stealing first. Stealing, you steal stuff so you can use it. You get it for free. I mean, that's just basic stealing. But breaking things goes back to this psychological need to feel important. It's like when someone breaks something of beauty or tears it down, or people spray paint things and they put graffiti on stuff. They have a feeling of power. They feel important for a few seconds. They've made an impact on the world. They've impacted how other people are going to react to something. So it's fulfilling the psychological need to feel important. So even though you're destroying something, you're affecting someone else. Like, oh, this person has this. I'm going to bash the shit out of this so he can't use it anymore. Look what I can do. Now, it's all negative. There's a lot of negativity in these Eskimo villages, but like I said, these are the realities that you have to deal with. You have to learn to accept and work with if you're going to be there. Now, there are some whites that go into the villages and they're there for a long time, or they might marry an Eskimo woman. Now, in that case, you're going to be more accepted. You're going to be one of them, and then they will respect your property. But until you earn that respect, your stuff is fair game.
That's very interesting. And I assume the intermarriage isn't common, but if it does happen, how has it turned out in the long term?
Yeah, it's not that. It's not that common, but I think it turns out fairly well. For example, if you were to look at pictures of all the modern day Eskimos, and then look at photographs of Eskimos from 100 years ago, they don't look exactly the same because there's been a lot of white admixture. There's been a lot of race mixing with whites. They're much lighter skinned now than they used to be. They used to be much darker. And so
Okay.
that's just an accepted part of the culture with the Eskimos, also with the American Indians. I think of all of the different races in the United States, the American Indians by far have the most race mixing. I mean, if they keep that up, they're going to slowly race mix themselves out of existence. I mean, their people are going to be a very low percentage of their bloodline.
That's very interesting. So another question I want to ask is, you've mentioned that these people are a Stone Age people, and that they developed the skills to live in a very, very harsh environment. And, you know, that is actually interesting, because that Professor Lin in Britain is the main guy who's pushed the idea that the reason Europeans are clever is because of extreme hardship compared to, let's say, the people, the races that lived at the equator, the blacks. So it's interesting that the Eskimos live in an extremely harsh environment. Their IQ is clearly quite a lot higher than that of blacks, because what are blacks? Like in the 70s, low 70s. And but the Eskimos don't seem to have developed further. And the only thing I can think of is that I recall that Professor Lin said something about, you also need to have a certain number of people in a population. In other words, you need to have more people, otherwise that IQ thing doesn't really sort of take off. So I'm wondering if the Eskimos are like stuck in that state because maybe they were always so few. I don't know how many there used to be.
Yeah, I've thought about that a few times myself, and I haven't seen enough literature that has studied those things to where it really provides any information that, you know, enlightens me. The Eskimos who are in Alaska and have stretched across top of Canada and then into Greenland, I think they've been there for about 5,000 years. So first of all, nobody is native to the Americas. I know people like to say Native American. There's no such thing as that.
Yes, agreed.
So they're Asian who migrated over. Now, what latitudes, what type of climate they grew up in Asia, I'm not sure. And there is a bit of a difference between the Eskimos and the Chinese, the Japanese, the Koreans, the Mongolians. You can see the similar features just because of how they look, especially if you go back and look at the older photographs before there was any race mixing with Russians and Americans. But I don't know all the exact mechanisms that caused Europeans to advance the way they did, and then, you know, Asians advanced the way in the direction that they did, and then what stymied the Eskimos and just stopping right there. You know, one of the things that might be a factor is that there's so few natural resources to even work with up in what's called Bush Alaska, where in the wintertime you basically have nothing. There's no trees there. There's some little scrub bushes. there's some tundra. Tundra, it doesn't mean snow. Tundra means this very thick vegetation, moss, very spongy grass, that type of stuff. It stands up about 10 feet tall. It's very, very hardy, very thick. That's what tundra is. So there's tundra, almost no trees at all. You're going to get driftwood once in a while. You're going to be using primarily seal blubber and whale blubber and meat and bones and melting the fat to make oil and these sorts of things. You're, the food that you eat, you're just eating raw fish. You're eating raw fish. That's your diet, and you're subsisting on that perfectly fine. Because there wasn't a lot of tools that they could even work with to start, you know, inventing things that might have been detrimental to them, you know, moving beyond that Stone Age point. And again, why people migrated down into warmer climates, but some people stayed in Alaska and then moved across in northern Canada and Greenland, I don't know. I guess they must have liked that lifestyle. I don't know. That's beyond my expertise.
Very interesting. So you, I like your argument. Interesting argument that the insane harshness of the region is such that there isn't much else you can do, and Yeah, very interesting. Wow. It makes me think that you're almost when you were there, because the next I almost have to ask you is like, what the heck motivated you to want to go and do that?
Well, first of all,
Sorry,
there's
but I had
always
to ask.
no, that's a fair question. First of all, there's always the ignorance of what you're about to get yourself into. And reality of it was when the time when I was getting into teaching, where I was, there were not many teaching opportunities. And a guy who was the superintendent of the school where I did my student teaching before I got my teaching certification, he said, "Look, I used to teach in these places in Alaska. And if you want to go to a place where you are guaranteed that you can find a teaching job, you go up to this teaching fair that takes place every springtime in Anchorage, Alaska. It's at the Hotel Captain Cook. All of the Alaskan school districts are going to be there. You fly up there, you interview with those, and then you'll work with some different districts, and then they'll pick you, and you pick one, and then you sign the contract, and that's where you're going to go." So I said, "Yeah, okay, I'll do that." And then when you show up there, you think, "Oh crap! Like what the hell did I get into?" It's like, "Well, I'm stuck here now, so just get used to it. Just think of it as an adventure." Our people have been stuck in situations like that forever. Imagine getting conscripted into an army and you go to another country and fight in another war and you live in a ditch for a year. I mean, it's just, we do those sorts of things.
I
We
understand.
do,
I
don't we?
understand, eh?
Yeah.
Yeah, you're not a crybaby. You just
No.
go and bite the bullet and go and do it. I know exactly where you're coming from. Because in some ways, your teaching up there, it makes me think of Christian missionaries who've gone all across Africa, even until recent times, you know. They also go to these places and they're busy trying to teach these people and doing various things. In that village of 500, how many whites were there?
There's about 16 or 17.
Oh wow. What are the different things that they're doing?
Most of them were teachers. There was one guy who was a preacher, priest, whatever. I can't remember what denomination he had there. So he ran a church. One guy was the brother of a teacher who had grown up in Fairbanks or Anchorage, and he just went out and moved to that village and just lived there. So, like, okay, it's where you want to live. And then one guy was, let's see, I'm trying to think if there was anyone else. I think that's pretty much it. That's all the white people. Yeah, it doesn't like when you show up in a village like that, and you're a white person and you get off the plane, like everyone knows, like boom, there's another teacher right there. Now everyone knows who you are instantly. You can't go
Wow.
anywhere without everyone knowing who you are. And when I came back to the States, I didn't want to be around people that knew me for a while, because when you're a teacher in a little village like that, every single time you walk outside, you're swarmed by the Eskimo kids that are around you constantly. Which is good and bad, but sometimes you think like, damn it, I just want to be left alone.
So when they swarm around you, is it a good swarming or a bad swarming?
Oh no, it was basically a good swarming. They're wanting to play, they're wanting to do stuff, they want to tell you stories. And I was there with my dog, and my dog was a pretty cool dog, and they wanted to play with the dog, and they would offer me like, "Hey, can I buy your dog, or I'll trade two of my dogs for your dog?" And like, no, you're not. Don't look at my dog. Don't touch my dog. Don't talk to my dog. Like, don't get close to my dog. Anything happens to my dog, I'm gonna rain down hell in this village. So just go easy. There was another teacher there at the same time that had two dogs, and one of them was larger. It was like a husky malamute breed, and it got shot in the neck. It survived, but because the Eskimos are so trigger happy, when I said they shoot the shit out of everything, I mean it. They see an animal anywhere, they kill it. It's dead instantly. So they shot her dog. There's another little dog that I would go off on runs sometimes after school if it didn't get down below 22 below zero. 22 below zero, I would run in. If it got cooler than that, that's my cutoff. So I'd go for runs with my dog, and there'd be this other little sort of wiener dog that would run with us. I think the dog's name was Happy. And then one day Happy was never around anymore. And it turns out that somebody shot it. I mean, they just shoot the shit out of everything. And let me say this as well, because this is a thing that bothered me when I got there. The very first day I got there, I get off the plane. Principal picks me up in a little SUV, one of the few trucks in town. They get taken down to the house where I'm going to be. And there's this Eskimo kid. He's holding this little dog. And most of the dogs in the village are like little runts. They're small. They're not that big. And he's got the dog around the neck, and he's slamming the dog's head into a building. This is my introduction into the village. He's trying to like smash this dog's head, and then I stop him. Like, what the hell is wrong with you? Anyway, there's some other things wrong with that kid. And then the next day I see this kid, the same dog. He's holding the dog by one of its front legs and just kind of like just la, 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 walking around. Well, this dog's, you know, ligaments and everything are getting torn and stretched out. I'm like, nope, stop that. It's like, God damn it. So they treat animals horribly, horribly. And the only other people I've seen treat animals that horribly was one of the, well, different Indian tribes treat them pretty bad. And then what I saw the Egyptians doing with donkeys over there in Cairo. So they just treat them like absolute shit. So as a white person, I don't like seeing that.
That's very interesting. The blacks don't treat their animals well either. In southern Africa, in the townships, blacks used to just be scrawny creatures that don't really care. They're half starved and that kind of thing. But this sounds like a lot of deliberate cruelty. It's very interesting. You know, the whole topic of whites and animals is a topic that I've thought about many times. I've actually wanted to do videos about it, but just never prioritized it high enough, because in our history, we've dealt with animals a lot, and we seem to have become very close to animals as a race. And you can see it with lots of whites everywhere. And we have an empathy for animals. And do you know the blacks used to remark that whites, this is in the days of colonialism, blacks used to remark that white people treated their animals better than we treated blacks. you know, there is truth to that. But then again, my counter argument to that is that, you know, animals do not carry out acts of treason and backstabbing. So, yeah. so that's why we treat our animals better, and we can trust our animals. They don't come and work to destroy us. But you're right. We've got a lot of empathy. And by the way, the craziest number of people who loved animals was in Rhodesia. In Rhodesia, people were nuts. You could get into somebody's car and they'd have like a couple of dogs in their car, and that would be like common, eh? And people like really liked animals in a big way. We all had animals. We had like a couple of dogs and so forth. Nothing particularly fancy, but lots of dogs especially. But we're not cruel to animals. And it's obviously we've got a certain empathy for living creatures, and then we extend it to Jews and others.
Well, you know, having said that, I can segue and talk about the American Indian tribe for just a little bit there. The tribe that I worked with, I lived on the edge of the reservation. So in the school district where I taught, the population was 85% Indian. And out on the reservation, what you'll see if you ever come to a little gas station, or there'll be these little buildings which serve as meeting places for local districts within the reservation, there'll be these stray dogs running around. And maybe about a quarter of the time, these stray dogs are going to have three legs instead of four legs because they got run over. because they're scrounging for food around gas stations a lot of the time, and people don't watch. They don't care if they hit them. They just back up, drive, whatever. They do not give a shit at all. And they don't spay or neuter their dogs. They don't take care of them. There's just, you know, tons of them running around. And once again, you'll have whites who will come in, spay and neuter dogs, come in, you know, clean the teeth of kids. Here's free toothbrushes. Here's a toothpaste. This is how you brush your teeth. We'll give you some immunization. Here's some shots. You know, we'll give shots for your dogs, you know, like for $5 a dog instead of $200 a dog, like you would at a pet. So there's these companies or these organizations, which again, will extend a lot of effort to help out the Indians on the reservations, but they would never do that for white people. They just do that on the reservations. But the reservations themselves are a bit dysfunctional. To me, it wasn't as bad as being in this up close in this little Eskimo village, which would be the height of this dysfunctionality. But it's pretty much the same thing. It's spread out over a larger area. And there's a lot of differences between, you know, how Indians operate and how white people operate. And nobody should be surprised that it turns out that way, because we evolved separately for the entire time that we were here on the planet until just a few hundred years ago. So why in the hell should we operate the same? And we don't operate the same. And some people are starting to find that out now with all the so-called diversity hires, et cetera, where things don't work. And we think, well, oh, how come they're not working? It must be the racisms. No, it's because they never designed these systems. They didn't design the civilization that could design the system, that could design the technology that's employed. And they wouldn't keep it up to our standards either. So it's just the reason that I'm talking about this stuff is there's a huge disparity between the different races, and trying to pretend that they're all the same is a bunch of bullshit. And if you have a white civilization and it is upheld to white standards, whether white people are doing that or some other non-whites coming in, you know, that will work. But when society becomes anti-white, we're inundated with anti-white propaganda, and whites start being replaced, and white standards start being replaced or just done away with, then you start to see things falling apart, which I would imagine the greatest examples on the planet would be Zimbabwe and South Africa.
Yeah, and the rest of Africa, make no mistake. So these reservations, I mean, when I listen to an Indian details of an Indian reservation, to me, that is almost like what we in Africa would call a black homeland, because we also had like reservations for blacks. But there seems to be maybe slight differences. Like in Rhodesia, there were black tribal, we called it a black tribal trust land. So in a black tribal trust land, only blacks are allowed to live there. And there would be maybe a white guy who's in charge of the tribal trust land with a couple of staff, and they would have maybe a clinic and a few other things. So it sounds like a similar thing, but we didn't give the blacks as much stuff as you give them, mainly because Rhodesia was much poorer. You know, I must stress this, that whites in Africa are a lot poorer because we are so few. So it's not like you, where you outnumber the Indians and outnumber the Eskimos, and you've got lots of, let's call it, surplus from what you are doing. So for you to hand out a whole bunch of stuff to those people is like pocket change to you. In Africa, that wouldn't be, in Africa, that's impossible for the whites, because what you would regard as pocket change, we cannot afford. That's a fact, and that's maybe something I haven't stressed in the past.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. I know in the past that we did not have the welfare programs in the United States that we do now, And we, of course, didn't have all the millions of non-whites flooding in that we were supporting, that our government does now, against the wishes of the American people. And yeah, the reservation system is basically like a homeland system, and it is for the different tribes. Now, I have known some people who were not Indian that were living on reservation land, and I don't know what they worked out with the tribal leaders for that, but it's not totally unheard of. Now, the reservation land, you can drive through it. Sometimes there's highways or roads or whatever through there, but there are slightly different jurisdictions, law jurisdictions inside those tribal lands, inside those reservations, where you will have a tribal government, you have tribal police, and you have some other individuals involved with the overseeing of the government there, and they interact with the federal government. And if you're an Indian living on a reservation, you can leave the reservation whenever you want. The reservation is just extra land from a point of view, extra land just for you. Now, that may be the exact land that your ancestors lived on for a long time, or you might have been moved from a different place and put on a reservation. Like, for example, a lot of the Indians in the American Southeast, they were moved westward until they got to Oklahoma. And then they've got reservations in Oklahoma, where you've got Indians, some in California, you got Navajo in Arizona, then you've got the Lakota, Sioux, whatnot in the Dakotas that are still basically on their same land that they grew up with. So whites aren't allowed to do that. Whites are not allowed to have their own little reservations like that, but Indians is fine. And there's other things that have been extended to the Indians over time, such as gambling. In most of the states, gambling is illegal, but on Indian reservations, if they choose to have that as legal, it can be legal if the reservation government votes it. So people will come to the reservations, put a lot of money into the slot machines, etc., ching 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 ching, and the reservations make money that way. Plus, there are federal set-asides that are just for American Indians, where that money doesn't go anywhere else. And when I taught on the edge of the reservation, what the school district was trying to do is get as many kids, as many Indian kids as they could into the school district, because for every kid that you have in school that's enrolled in the school, you get a certain amount of money from the government, okay, to help you fund your school. But if it's an Indian kid, you get 1.5 that amount. And so in this high school where I was, there were a lot of extra programs that would usually not be available to high school kids, but they were available in this high school because there was enough money to fund it, because there was a bunch of Indian kids there. So non-whites get special favors from our government because our government is anti-white.
Wow. So there's like 50% more money for Indians per Indian kid, if I understand correctly.
Yes. Yep. Yes.
Wow. Wow. Yeah. At the end of the day, it doesn't matter how you play this equality thing. Equality is a bunch of junk. It's rubbish. It's not real. I have a bunch of questions that I've built up from from the various things that you've said, and I'm just going to go through them in like chronological sequence.
Okay.
So let me just fire away. In your Eskimo village, you must have had electricity. How did it work if you are there in the middle of nowhere?
Yeah, let's see. We have for the heating, it was our propane that was brought either down the rivers or up from Seattle during the summertime. And I'm trying to think, where the heck did the electricity come from?
Didn't you have generators?
No, we didn't have. Okay, for some of the buildings and the schools, yeah, I think we had some sort of generators that were running off of gas, but there were also some power lines. I'm trying to remember where that was getting generated from. There was even there was one little tiny hill next to that village, and there was a microwave mast up on top of there. There weren't cell phones there at that time when I was there. The technology was being put in. So that's a good that's a good question. Like, again, it never occurred to me where the heck was the electricity coming from. Now you've got me bothered, and I'm going to have to look that up.
Okay, no
problem. Give you the answer.
Just curious.
Yeah.
And it's fun. It's like
it's a good question.
It's like, you know, a lot of your discussion about up there in Alaska. And Mike, pardon me for cramming my way, shoving my way in on this one. But when I listen to your stories, it sounds, you know, it's got elements of colonialism, because it's there's similarities. You are living in a sort of a uncolonized area, and you are living in quite a raw state. But I find it really interesting, Mike, Brant, sorry. And question: you were saying that the Eskimos were also drunk and were cursing, but I want to ask you: do the Eskimos have their own language? What language do they speak?
Yeah. Okay. So there's two major tribes that I know of the Eskimos. There's the Inuit, which are up on the northern coast, and then there's the Yupik, which are further south, and they have their own languages. But most of them do not speak their own language that hasn't been passed down to them. There's a few of them that do, just like with the different Indian tribes across the U.S. I don't know what the percentages are. I would guess like maybe a third of the Eskimos and the Indians still can speak their own language. And it's getting that percentage is getting smaller with each generation because they're relying on English more. And when you get on the internet and, you know, your TalkTik and your TikTok and your Facebook and all this sort of crap, you know, it's in English. So they're not respecting what their elders did. Now, they're not very competent at speaking English either. They can't quite grasp how to do that. So not only are they within a dysfunctional no man's land with their society in general, they're in a no man's land just with speaking. And they would do strange things. For example, let's see. When I was trying to teach writing to the kids, they had trouble between past, present, and future tense of a verb. And so what they did to show past tense of a verb is they would just put the word had in front of the verb. Like you want to say, we are going shopping. Now tell me how you did that in the past. We had shopping. We had shopping. Okay. We had shopping yesterday. We had swim yesterday.
Oh,
you know, we had whatever. They just put that there because they just are not introduced to language early enough to where it's developing in their minds and they can master it and understand it as they pass through school. So it's just this stuff it's not working that well.
I ask, could it have anything to do with them not having a concept of time in the same way that we do? I'm asking.
You know, I have heard of that about some different African tribes where they have tiny little languages. I didn't hear anything about them not having a concept of time. I think that they had a concept of time that was okay. One of the strange things about that was when we were talking about calendars and dates and stuff, and I would say, how long is it until such and such happens as we're teaching calendars? And they would say, it is 12 nights. So they wouldn't say days, they would say nights instead.
Okay.
But they could count nights. So they did have a concept of that.
No, because like with that cursing thing, I was just wondering when you said they were cursing, I wondered how you could understand that they were cursing.
Oh, it was the F word, and it was really, really loud. And I think it was It was Eskimo males in their 20s, which is just about the most worthless type of person on the planet, an Eskimo male in his 20s that doesn't have a job. And they were fighting over the like the one woman in the village that they were all trying to share or something like that. So I think that's what all the yelling was about. So that was nice.
Okay, yeah, because you also mentioned the incest thing. So the sounds, go for it.
Okay, so let me say this. Thank you for didn't mention this. So when I'm there in the village, there's basically six different facial types, six different faces. And everyone in the village has one of those six faces. It's not like there's 500 different faces. There's six different faces, and everyone's got one of those faces. And it turns out that I learned from one of the teachers who had been there for a while and who, you know, stayed there and lived there, that a lot of the kids in the school were brothers and sisters, but they didn't know it. And that's why they all looked the same. So a lot of them all had the same dad. They just had different moms, and they weren't told that they were brothers and sisters. And a lot of those kids there were raised by their grandmas, by their umma, or their aunt, because their parents were so dysfunctional that they couldn't be raised by their parents.
Brant, that's interesting. I was actually going to ask you, do they know who their fathers are? Let's say, live in Chicago.
I would guess that somewhere between 35 to 45% of the kids know who their fathers are.
Wow.
Very interesting. Very interesting. Yeah, see, these people, you know, and when you were mentioning the drinking, there's also drinking in among certain groups in South Africa, but I think the Aborigines in Australia have got like an enormous drinking problem. And I assume that these things are because they don't have anything else to do. They are kind of stuck and bored.
I just want to jump in, Jan, to offer a little bit of different view on this and what you're bringing up. It's also a form of escape. You can do it if you're bored. You can do it for an escape. So while you're drunk, you're feeling pretty damn good. That's why people are doing drugs. And when I was there, I had a really good principal, and he was very concerned with turning the kids around as I was. God damn it, let's bring up a generation that's functional, that can make their own decisions, that can learn from their ancestors or learn how to, you know, do things in a white world. And he was saying that what they need is a win. They need to see an example of someone from their village who wasn't just a complete fuck up, which is all that they ever see. And that was something that was that was difficult to do, because it takes, in a village like that, it's going to take some people with a hell of a lot of discipline and a vision for what they want to do and a vision for what they can be and some pride in what their ancestors were. They got to have all of that, and they've got to hold that together until they can make something with their lives, and then they will be a role model for younger ones. And there was one guy who had joined the Marines, and then he had come back to the village for you know, these people, when they leave this teeny tiny little place, they might go out and live in the States somewhere or join the military, but then they all came back, because that tiny little village, as strange as it is for someone like me, that's what they were comfortable with. They weren't comfortable being, you know, outside of that. But if they could somehow get enough people who were competent and who held on a job and who were not drunk, who were educated, you know, who could speak, that provides role models for the younger kids. Now, since I moved away from there, I don't know if more people have developed along those lines or not. But that's the problems that I see. It was very obvious.
Yeah, you raise a deep question here. The question about, and the blacks have got this thing too, the question of inferiority and realizing that they're inferior and that they don't win and they can't win. And it's because they're up against European civilization. Western society is very powerful. It's a very rough and tough system that we've actually got. It's, and nobody can match it. You know, it's and when I look at the blacks, a lot of liberalism strikes me as being so that black people can feel better about themselves. And then there's and you know, that's why where was it that I heard it? Some black kid was saying a couple of years ago, "Oh, I can be an astronaut. I can be a scientist." And then it's like that's what they've been told, and then they're like, "Yeah, so I have some kind of future," even though it's actually whites just, you know, giving them a freebie, you know. Yeah, sure. You can, you know, we'll allow you to be an astronaut, not because you really have the skills, but because, you know, we will give you the chance. But the important thing is for them to feel good about themselves. And this is something that I've thought about quite a lot, because I also look at Jews trying to break down Jews and liberals. Trying to break down whites who do feel good about themselves. So, and that takes us down to starting to become dysfunctional like some of these other people. So it's a interesting thing. I was very surprised when you were saying that some of those Indian reservations have got their own government and police. I never knew that. I am
Oh yeah,
very,
yep, they
I'm
do.
very surprised by that. And let me ask you, how many Indians, on average, a rough number, how many Indians would live in an Indian reservation?
Oh, you mean in like just pure population
Yes,
numbers?
pure population numbers. What are you looking at? 500 or 5,000 or what?
Geez. Well, there's small ones and there's big ones, and I would say they range from maybe a couple thousand up to 30,000, 35,000.
Okay. So it's a much bigger society than the Eskimos, but it's interesting if they've got a government. Since so, I don't know how long they've had a government and police and that kind of thing, but you know, them having their own government and police, it sounds like they're trying to run their own society, and that would be exactly the same thing that the whites of South Africa did with homelands. Homelands worked exactly like that. Rhodesian tribal trust lands did not work like that. Blacks were not their own government. But in South Africa, the white South Africans under apartheid made homelands that were exactly like that. There were some homelands that even had their own parliament, their own laws. They were even regarded legally as a separate country, though only South Africa recognized them as a separate country. But I mean, with these Indians and these Eskimos, well, okay, with the Indians, I mean, if they're running their own government and police, how well is that working? They sound more functional than the Eskimos. Or am I jumping
Well,
the gun there?
I think that the tribal police, as far as I know, it works as well as any police that you see anywhere else, except maybe South African police are a bit of a mess. But the tribal police, I don't think people hate them or disrespect them or think that they are ridiculous. I think that they're all right. And I knew some Navajo or what were they? I don't remember what tribe they were. Some different teachers who had some husbands who were tribal police. So they were fine, and I met some of them. Now, some of the governments of these reservations, you find the same problems with lots of our governments, where you have corruption, where what they will do is they have the ability to award contracts, and they have the ability to say where money goes if there's any tourism on the reservation. And they can say, you know, who lives here and who lives over here, you know, in this place, and that sort of thing. So because they can play with money, or they say where money goes and where it doesn't go, then they will start making bad decisions. They will enrich their own pocket sometimes. And then also, they will have a little bit of an, maybe have an altercation with towns that are outside of the reservation, because towns outside of the reservation are places where you can buy alcohol if you want to. And on the reservation, technically, legally, people are not supposed to drink on some of these reservations. So all these, the Indians either hitchhike or they drive. They somehow they get off the reservation, go into town, get drunk, and then cause a nuisance in town. So the mayor of a town, he starts saying bad things about these Indians, and then the, you know, the leader of the reservation, I forgot what his title is, he, you know, he starts firing back, you know. And so there's this little feud on Facebook, and then something something racist here, and something something, no, you guys are drunk, and you know, this type of crap goes on. So you it's almost like this tiny little nation where you get in altercations with people off the reservation. Plus, also, you might make some good decisions, and then you're making decisions where you're just a corrupt, you know, turd after a while. So it's the same type of thing that we see with the typical government anywhere.
Jan,
So, go for it.
let me add something. I you know, I believe in self-determination, self-government for all people, but I don't want I actually just had to search this just now so I could get the facts right, but I wouldn't want to leave the impression that this is a true self-governance, because these fall under what a US government agency called the Bureau of Indian Affairs. I just searched their budget for 2025 is $4.6 billion, and they are considered rendering service to, it says, 2 million indigenous Americans across 547 federally recognized tribes. So self-rule, self-governance isn't, I wouldn't say, is a fully accurate way to look at it. It looks like a tremendous welfare program from the outside. So in a way, these people are kind of trapped in a very bad system, as in some of what Brandt has described.
This is very interesting.
Yeah,
Sorry.
yeah. So I'm glad you brought that up, because this is the thing that I kept dealing with in my own mind, being in Bush, Alaska, or working with the reservations, is that there's a complaint from the Eskimos or the Indians that we don't want the white people here. We don't want you telling us what to do. You messed up our way of life. You moved us from this land to this land, etc. But also at the same time, we're more than happy to take all of your money, all of your technology, everything that you've created. We're going to piggyback on top of that, and we're still going to complain about you. So, you know, I say that's bullshit. Like, you can't do that. You need to knock that crap off. Like, what do you want it to be? Do you want to go back just to your own people? And I'm completely in favor of there being some lands where white people don't go on. And it's just the, you know, people who consider themselves indigenous to that area, go for it, buddy. Absolutely go for it. And I would say, if I was the, you know, leader of the world, there's not going to be any highways, there's not going to be any trains, there's not going to be any planes flying over this area. You leave them alone and they just do their own thing. But don't come to me telling me that you want my medicine, you want my technology, you want my TV, you want my cell phones, you want my hospital, you want my education, you want my pickup trucks. Be realistic. Like, let's get down to the bare bones. Let's wipe away all the feminism, wipe away all the bullshit, and just be honest. We're not the same. That's why there's problems. We're not built the same. There's no such thing as equality. Be honest with everything, and let's come to the best solution. That has never been done. Because there's so many factors with so many people, so many desires from governments wanting different things, and people feeling sorry for other people, and they go, okay, well, we should all feel white guilt because we've been so successful. We should take part of our money and just constantly give it away to other people. because we've just been told to do that. So that's, again, another reason why it started the School of the West, is to start laying down some foundations for kids to say, look, here's what's really going on. And as you grow up, you're going to find out that the world is very, very complex. We have a lot of different people with a lot of history, and a lot of people are actually going to be lying to you as well. So you've got that to deal with. You've got to maneuver through all of this intricacy of nonsense to come to the truth. And in the future, once white people reclaim their own lands again, you're going to have to decide, how do you interface with these other races? How do you interface with whites that have turned against us? You know, how are we going to control our resources, et cetera?
Great question.
Yeah. Jan, did you have more questions or did I cut you off?
Oh, goodness. Here I am busy talking and I was on mute. I apologize. So I actually enjoyed it once you got worked up and once you got worked up and you were in there and you said that, you know what, if you can't have some of our stuff while complaining at the same time, if you want to go and live by yourself, then go and live by yourself, but don't ask for our medicine or anything else. And the reality is that these non-whites, if we had to leave them alone, which I am 100% in favor of, lots of them will die. They will really struggle because their way of life was very backward. And in the case of Africa, I have absolutely no problem with let them rule themselves, and you know, to let the, you know, don't give them the freebies anymore. Let them go and you know, see to it that they plant their food and obtain their stuff however they need it. Yeah, I'm 100% with you, because I don't see this nannying thing as being a good thing. And you know, if you get down to the raw reality of life, my understanding was that there was even a time when humans were in zoos. I remember a young guy in America telling me this. He said to me that he actually raised the issue of Hitler. He said that Hitler removed certain people from zoos, that there were humans that were kept in zoos. And you know, these people, like these Eskimos who are so few and far between, you know, they could easily have just been treated like animals and just hunted out of existence. You know, the only reason they exist is because whites have allowed them to exist. That they in no way, shape, or form have the power to challenge whites. And if they want to live, if they wanted just a piece of land and say, you know, this is our area where we live and fish, I don't have a problem with it. I don't think they'd be any better off. They'd live in real hardship, the way their ancestors lived. And the same would be true for the blacks in Africa. And I am all for that, I must tell you, 100%. I don't think that it's a wise thing to, I don't know if either of you guys have ever read or looked at the stuff from Ben Clarkson, but Ben Clarkson has made the point. Ben Clarkson made the point that I personally like Ben Clarkson's thinking. I think he's very clever. Ben Clarkson said that every species of animal colonizes to the maximum that it physically can. No species gives another species any freebies at all. You know, maybe symbiotic and parasitic relationships excluded, but, you know, a person doesn't owe them anything. The truth is, our civilization is the one that's actually expanding. And I just want to ask you a quick question. When you say that it's illegal for them to drink, is it illegal as a law inside the reservation for them not to drink? do they get punished if they drink? Which, by the way, sounds like apartheid, because you're saying that that whites are allowed to drink, but Indians are not allowed to drink. So
what I'm saying on the reservation that has that law, or in the Eskimo villages, nobody is allowed to drink. Alcohol is illegal in those places.
Even for teachers.
Yeah, okay. Even for teachers.
Okay, exactly. So that's how they apply.
Even if you really, really want to be drunk right now, but you can't because of the Eskimos cause so much problem when they drink, so now you can't drink either, even though you wouldn't have a problem with it. So that is what they call native law. Of course, again, they're not native, so they're not natives. It's Eskimo law or the Indian law of the tribe, and you get locked up or whatever they do. Normally, they'll get locked up for a while if they're drunk.
Okay. All right, two final questions from me. Gambling. The gambling on the Indian reservations, it makes me think of something that happened in South Africa. When under apartheid we had different homelands for blacks, there was one particular homeland called Bophuthatswana, and in that homeland was like pro-capitalist, etc. That was what those blacks decided to do. And then in South Africa, gambling under apartheid, I think, was illegal. I don't know exactly how illegal. I don't know the finer detail of which gambling was allowed and when and where. But gambling, like those big casinos, that kind of gambling was not allowed in South Africa. So a Jew by the name of Saul Kirzner, who had a bunch of hotels, he went to Bophuthatswana, opened up a place called Sun City, which is basically South Africa's miniature version of Las Vegas. And then all the gambling and whoring and everything that's not allowed in South Africa is allowed in Bophuthatswana. And so they made tons of money. And I will tell you, the white Christians, Afrikaans people of South Africa would then trundle off quite regularly off to Sun City to go and do all the naughty things that you're not allowed to do in apartheid South Africa. So that is the use and abuse of money.
So he made a little Weimar Republic in South Africa?
Yes, he made tons of money. He's still alive. And I think he's somewhere near Florida. He's busy. He was busy on some islands and stuff. Saul Kirzner, if you want, I can give you the name. He's busy in America doing his stuff. He became a billionaire out of all this naughty stuff that he got up to. But just quick, spots the opportunity to go do the naughty thing. And in a society where whites can just choose anything they want. So even the Christians headed off regularly to Sun City, or as they called it, Sin City. So there you go, eh? So exactly the same kind of rubbish, eh? And there is one other thing I want to ask you, because I think we'd have a lot of fun talking about, this notion of Native Americans, and that there's no such concept, because that's something I've been looking at and been digging into it quite a bit, and I totally agree with you. But I want to ask you this. I've heard from other Americans that since the Indians are really Asians who've come via the Bering Strait, I've heard it said that some of the Indians who were more on the East Coast were actually more white and might even have links to places like Britain, etc., that there is something, somehow, sometime, mm-hmm. they got there. Is that true in your view?
Yeah, as far as I know, that is true. So there's, to the best of my knowledge, there's three major migrations to the Americas. 14,000 years ago, when the ice corridor opened up down through Canada and Idaho, Montana, etc., into United States, the Asians finished their migration down. Now, that's one of them. There's another one that occurred previous to that along the West Coast that is theorized that it was done by boat people who were hugging the coast, kind of like how you describe the Chinese hugging the coast when they sailed to Africa, because there are fossil evidence of people who had been around a long time before 14,000 years ago. And some of those finds might also be underwater right now off of the West Coast. So that's another one. The other migration occurred approximately 20,000 years ago, and this was white people, what they call the Salutrians. And there's already enough evidence of this that's in place, and I won't go into it now, but I am going to do lessons on School of the West for kids on this. Now, at what time the Salutrians disappeared, we don't know. But there are chromosomal evidence from some Indians that are in eastern Canada that matches up with chromosomes from Europe. So the theory is that probably some of those Salutrians interbred with the Asians that had migrated across. And that's why there's a chromosome difference between Indians in eastern Canada and Indians in the rest of the Americas.
Oh wow. I was wondering whether you were going to bring up my favorite subject, the Salutrians, because that is a hot topic. So anything you ever have on the Salutrians that's newer, I'm always interested, because I looked into that a couple of years ago, and there was a particular academic who was busy with that. And I remember him seeing a video where he said that he had dated a certain type of Clovis, I think it was Clovis stuff, and the date had come back as 18,000 years ago, and it was related to this Clovis technology was that was matching southern France. But what happened to that academic afterwards? I've not seen anything from him in years.
No, he died.
He died.
Yeah, he died some years back. That's why you don't hear anything from him anymore, unfortunately. Now,
What?
he had a mate in England who was also working on the theory with him, and I don't know what he's done since then.
Oh wow, because man, I was looking at that stuff and I was blown away by it. And I've e the and you know that whole thing of how the whites from southern France came across during an ice age, hugging the icebergs and so forth. Man, it was what a story. But you know something else, Brant, that I'm a little bit just a little bit further. I have looked into whether there are other more recent times when whites got to North and South America. It was something I dug into a little bit, but never made enough time to completely finish, because I've got books where people have pointed out all kinds of things from Mexico right down to South America, where there's all kinds of strange stuff, as if even Vikings may have reached North and South America. But you know what's interesting is I once came across mention that the Brazilians reckoned that they'd found a Roman ship, and that there were, those amphora, is that the correct term? The sort of the vessels that they used for storing things in those times. I think it's called an amphora or something like that. They found that on the seabed. But I've never heard anyone go further on this thing of Vikings or Romans or any or Phoenicians or anyone else getting to North or South America. Oh, mind you, there is stuff of Vikings. Vikings. I'm not sure if is it Nova Scotia, up like near Canada. There is something about Vikings that got there, and that there was a settlement there in the last 1,000 years.
I think you're right, Jan. I think there's been, I have to brush up on it, but I think there's been plenty of evidence of visits by Europeans for up to 3,000 years to the Americas, but not permanent settlements that stuck. And so that, you know, what we're really, our education, you know, teaches us about the settlements that actually worked. And I've actually done a lot of research into my own family and found that I'm a descendant of both settlers for Massachusetts, like the Mayflower and other ships that came across, and Jamestown in different, you know, different arms of my family. And so those are the settlements that our history and our focus is on, because we're, you know, our founding stock Americans are descendants of those people. Whereas there's certainly other evidence of visits that we are not necessarily connected to directly, this in the same way that we are to our own, you know, the way that the United States was founded, America was founded. So
I understand. And Brandt, the Salutrians dying out.
Wait, I just want to say, Jan, I just want to say one thing. Yeah, that settlement that you're talking about was called Lance-Anx Meadows when I was a kid. Another name for that is Vinland.
Yes. Vinland. Yes,
you have
Vinland.
To look that up, you'll find it. Yeah, it's well known. And I was talking to someone who's from, I'll say, a European country who did some work for me. I did a little Viking series for School of the West. He said that he knows people from – no, wait. Sorry, I'm thinking of a different guy, a guy from Iceland who did some work. They're taught this information in schools when they're a kid, so they know all about it, which is part of their curriculum. But so anyway.
So people in Iceland know about people reaching America.
No, yeah, it's not like it's hidden or anything. I mean, the site's even been reconstructed.
Yes, Vinland is the thing I was thinking of. The one thing that I did come across that I think explains the death of the Salutrians was there's a strange term, and I'm just going to pronounce it phonetically as best I can say it. I think it's called the Young Dryas or something like that. It's got
That's the Younger Dryas.
Yes, and my understanding is that it was extremely dry and incredibly windy, something like that, and people and lots of life in Eastern America was killed. Is that correct?
Yeah, I don't know that much about it because I haven't looked into it. Just what I think Dennis Stanford, the person who was in charge of a department at the Smithsonian who was hitting up the research, just the things that he had talked about the Younger Dryas, and then also teaching a little bit of Earth and space science. I think there might have been a meteor impact at that time, and this caused material to go into the air, and things became colder. There was less sunlight. All the other things that happened, I don't know. Again, it's not something that I looked at. But this is getting into territory that I don't know about. I mean, I only know a certain amount.
Yeah. Well, it seems we've all gone to the edge of it. So you said that the scientist was Dennis Stanford.
I think it's Dennis Stanford, yeah.
Wow, man. I saved all the videos, and I think I've even got a PDF of one of the books. I find this stuff so interesting. You know, whites definitely traveled an insane amount in the past. I did put out a video about whites who got to New Zealand 2,000 years ago. If you guys haven't seen that, but
Yeah, I have seen that. It's good.
okay, all right. Anyway, guys, thank you very much. We spoke a bit too long, but I didn't want to. I didn't want to interrupt the flow.
Thanks, guys.
Okay,
Yep.
so
Thank you.
thank you very much. We'll chat again. After the show that we did with Brandt, where he was talking about his adventures among the Eskimos and the Indians, I actually asked him if he had any photographs because I couldn't quite picture it all in my mind. I may have a picture in my mind, but what I think he saw versus what things were actually like are two different things. So Brandt was kind enough to actually go and find some photos and send them to me for use in this video. So I'm about to show you these photos that he sent. So it was very nice of him. And one of the things that comes out as one gets to know Brandt and Mike is that Brandt is quite a wild guy. He is very much an athletic guy and a guy who is out to have adventures. I don't know if he's got some Viking in him or something Scandinavian, but he's very much out and about, a man who's out to do all kinds of different things. Here are the photos. This is the small plane that Brandt is about to fly in all the way to Alaska, and I must say, the little plane looks really small. Really small, and it's going to be going to a really remote place. And if the pilot makes a mistake, they're just going to die. And yeah, typical whites doing some rather risky stuff. And here's the little plane flying over a mountain range. I forget which mountain range he said he was flying over, but the mountain range is looking extremely barren, extremely nasty and barren. Very nasty. I'm sure if you're down there, you're not going to be able to find your way out easily, hey? And this is a photo of Brandt and the white pilot who's taking him there in this tiny plane of theirs. But the white pilot knows what he's doing. And here they are coming in to land at a remote region on that little airstrip. This is a very nice photo. This must obviously be summer, and it looks like a little Eskimo boy with what I think is Brandt's dog. And what a view! It looks so beautiful in the summer. Really looks nice. It's really pretty in summer and it's huge. Wow. And this is another little Eskimo boy with Brandt's dog. And so you can get a feel for what the village actually was like. So you can see there's like a little playground for the children with slides. The buildings are made of wood. Wooden buildings fascinate me because here in Africa, we actually don't construct wooden buildings. for whites. The only place where they do it is at Orania. And I think it is so useful. And it is such a nice feature of America, this thing of constructing wooden buildings. And here is Brandt taking a photo out of his window, so you can see some more of the wooden houses. And the man is just crazy, opening a window when it's this cold. But it'll give you an idea of what this place actually looked like. And here is Brandt's cross-country motorbike in the classroom. The man is a wild man. And here is Brandt running in the coldest of the cold weather. And as you can see, he's freaking tough, man. And there's his dog. I'm not sure if this is the midnight sun, whether this is just the sun setting, or whether this is what it looks like in winter when the sun is mostly below the horizon, or always below the horizon. But that's quite something. I can't even begin to imagine what it must be like to live there for weeks and months in the cold and not be able to see the sun properly. But it's actually very pretty. I didn't ask him, but I assume that there has to be a lot of the northern lights. And here is Brandt's dog by what appears to be a river or a lake. And look at the thick pieces of ice. Nature is so strong. So yeah. It's cold, it's strange, but it's a world that whites are actually used to, except for the small tribe sitting here on the bottom of Africa where we are totally spoiled. And here are Eskimo kids who are busy doing little things or making little things or carving little things. Not sure what exactly they are doing. And I assume this is Brandt and another white guy, maybe a teacher, I don't know. And they're out and about in the extreme cold. And it looks like they're out and about in the night. And they got their little they got their little headlights on. But it must have been really, really cold. And this is a Russian Orthodox church, because Alaska used to belong to Russia, and many of these Eskimos are actually Orthodox. And there on the left of it, you can see part of the cemetery. So yeah. Very nice. Looks small. Looks a bit small for this little village. And finally, Brandt didn't have a photo of that time when he drove, when he saw all those bison. And this was the best he could find that represents more or less what he saw on that drive of his. I just want to end off this show with a few thoughts. I must say, it amazes me to see the way Americans and Canadians function on their continent. How the Americans and the Canadians are totally and utterly at home on their continent, North America. North America is basically white, and their ancestors conquered and seized North America. And they are so happy and so comfortable in North America, even though they are colonials, just like the whites of Southern Africa, just like the Australians and New Zealanders. But the Australians and New Zealanders are also just as comfy on their home, whether it is beautiful New Zealand or rather rugged and dry Australia. But these whites who have settled on their different continents are very happy on their continents. And they feel very at home. And for them to see bison and bears and to be dealing with raccoons and all kinds of other animals that aren't native to Europe is quite interesting to watch. And you would think that they had lived there for 1,000 years. There were blacks who actually said, in the case of Rhodesia, there were blacks who said that the whites came as if they were going to stay for 1,000 years. I did come across a quote along those lines. And all whites function like that. And it's quite amazing to see these whites functioning on their continent where they are the total bosses. And the other inhabitants are a minor concern, a minor nuisance to them. And they even go out of their way to now assist these others. But it is quite fascinating for me to sit and watch how absolutely at home, totally and utterly at home, Americans are. As if they've been there for 10,000 or 100,000 years. But the difference between North America and Africa is the number of people who came. When enough whites came and enough whites were there to work together as a team and over a couple of hundred years to take control of that enormous territory, that is really what enables this and allows this to happen. Now, of course, the same thing could have happened in Africa. The same thing could have happened in South America or Latin America. But the real key takeaway is that this is only possible when you have enough people who can handle all the threats that come over a period of time. And the amount of territory which the Americans and Canadians have is enormous. They've got more territory than they need. So for them, they can't even think or conceive of expanding beyond their territory because they've got too much. And it is really incredible to see what whites do when enough whites get onto another continent. And they start producing a new Europe. That's what they do. However, the bizarre fact is that now that they are at the peak of their power, now suddenly they are losing confidence in themselves. And that is something that we need to talk about in other videos. I have been watching the way in which whites are losing confidence in themselves. And rest assured, you know who is behind all of this. If these whites had been left alone to think their own European thoughts in their own European heads, they would not be losing any confidence in themselves at all.
give up, my friend. If you don't see the end, if you don't see the top, don't stop. We know you'll win. Every fight you fight, every game you play, you'll reach the top. At the top, that is where you'll stay.